Welcome to the Curious Advantage podcast, an exploration of the idea of curiosity and its increasing importance for thriving in the digital age from the authors of The Curious Advantage.
Welcome to another episode of the Curious Advantage podcast, where we explore the seven C's of curiosity by having conversations with fascinating people. I'm Garrick Jones, and I'm joined by my fellow author, Paul Ashcroft.
Hello.
Today, we are delighted to be joined by Professor Steph van der Stichel. Steph is a professor in cognitive psychology at the Department of Experimental Psychology at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, and he's the head of the Attention Lab there. He's the author of a number of books, including How Attention Works and Concentration, which is published by MIT Press this month. Welcome, Steph.
Thank you very much.
We want to talk with you about attention and curiosity and focus, and why is that important?
Stephen, we've been, as you know, researching curiosity in our book, Curious Advantage, and we've been fascinated about the relationship between curiosity and how the brain works. What, from your perspective, do you understand by curiosity? How would you describe what curiosity is?
As a researcher, I study the visual domain, so what we pick up from the world around us. And curiosity, I think the brain is inherently curious because it has to pick up the information around us. It has to sample the environment. And we sample the environment by a process called attention. We focus our attention on the things that we want to explore, the things that we want to know more about, the things that are relevant to us. And what's relevant to you might not be relevant to me. So we all focus on different things in the world around us. And that, to me, is essential to curiosity, to pick up on the right information. And the fact that attention works such that we can only sample part of that external world and forces on us a decision about where to focus on. So we can all be in the same room. And the fact that we all have different views about the world, different tasks, makes a situation where we all focus our attention on different things. And if you're curious about the world around you, this means that you will focus your attention differently given sort of what type of curiosity you have or what you're curious about. Meaning that the way we sample the world is determined by what we want to pick up from the world around us. And I think that's a largely driving force when you think about curiosity.
Were you saying there that the way we receive information about the world and what we pay attention to, how we interpret that, is different for every individual?
I think we all perceive the world differently. If you look at a painting and someone is standing next to you, and this person knows a lot about art, and you might not be an art lover or have little knowledge about art, if you just look at sort of where people look, just look at the eye movement patterns, you will see that we sample that painting differently. And then if you then quiet and after that period you talk to each other, you immediately notice that both of you have picked up on very much different information. And that will also influence how you interpret the painting. I've had lovely experiences with people who know a lot about art telling me and informing me about where to look on a specific painting. I would never have been able to pick up on that information if I had not had that knowledge. So this influences how I perceive the world.
Steph, does the attention have to have a kind of knowledge framework to allow you to focus and move forward?
No, you can instruct in an experiment observers to look at an image without any task. You just look simply at an image and don't pay attention to anything specific. And then you will see that we all look roughly at the same things. So we look at salient items, so colors that automatically attract attention because they're unique in an image, or faces. We prefer to look at faces. And this is similar, yeah, between everyone. It's a very similar mechanism. However, in the vast majority, we have a task and we have previous experiences and you have a specific action that you have to perform. So you could say that we all have a sort of a default modus to look at things that are special in terms of color or faces or things that are simply conspicuous. However, I think in the vast majority of times, we actually have a task that we need to perform. You're looking for your keys or you're looking at a movie with a specific task that you want to perform or a specific aim. So yes, if you look at, for instance, traffic, in which we all have the same task, if you look at eye movement patterns, they are relatively They have less variability in the scan patterns between observers than, for instance, looking at a painting. So what we're curious about differs between participants and observers, but I'm actually talking about people.
So I've heard the phrase, it's the difference that makes the difference, if you know what I mean. Is our attention focused on things that are different or changing in the environment constantly? Do we have a short-term attention span, or do we have a longer-term ability to make sense of a situation?
That's an interesting question, because it's important to realize that from an evolutionary point of view, we have to pay attention automatically to certain things. And that is the same for all of us. So if something starts to move abruptly, we will all pay attention to that piece of information. We have to. It's one aspect of our behavior that has led us to survive. Because someone might cross the road or someone might enter the room and it might actually constitute a threat. So in a lot of information that is evolutionary relevant to us, so new information, moving information, that will automatically attract attention and it will disturb you from your task that you're doing. But a lot of people complain about this, right? I'm reading, but I'm being distracted all the time, or I try to go to work, but every time I cross the heavy road, I am distracted by all this information. And I agree that a lot of the information you're distracted by is irrelevant. So thinking about notification on your smartphone or this advertisement on this billboard that's flashing, that's completely irrelevant and it would be better to ignore it. But the brain, of course, doesn't know whether the thing that's flashing in your periphery is evolutionarily important because it's actually a threat, or is completely irrelevant. The brain doesn't know it. The brain only has sort of one modus. If something flashes, if something's moving, we should automatically move our attention towards that information. And it's interesting to know that a lot of people are actually using that knowledge not correctly. Like if you have notifications on your phone, a lot of the notifications are completely irrelevant. And still that makes use of the same system that it automatically will attract your attention and will disturb you from the task that you're doing.
Steph, you're talking a lot there about the nonverbal cues that we pick up and that divert our attention into different directions. How does that also relate directly to language and how language is used to attract our attention and in the way we focus?
So language is very much used in the way we guide our attention. So for instance, if you're looking for something, if you're looking for your keys, you almost imagine the word key and you also imagine how your keys look. So this will automatically guide your attention. So thinking about the color red will automatically guide you to red information. For instance, when you're searching for your book on your bookshelf. On the other hand, when you're exploring, when you're looking around, things that match, things that are important to you will automatically capture your attention and will also make sure that your attention sticks at that specific piece of information. So for instance, words in your environment that are relevant to you, sort of we read automatically, right? Things that are, that's why advertisement uses words that sort of scream relevance. So things that are related to violence or things that are related to sex, they can attract your attention and they can also make sure that your attention actually sticks at a specific text. So what people need to be aware of that you cannot just present information and people will pick up on that information. You have to capture someone's attention and also keep someone's attention at a text. So you have to make sure that you capture someone's attention before you can communicate a message. It's impossible to communicate a message without having someone's attention being paid to your message.
I think you've given us an interesting tip there. So what we can learn from external influence and input that advertisers, as you were saying, are working on giving us non-verbal and verbal cues at the same time. But if we're looking to direct our own attention, whether we've lost something or we want to pay attention to a particular topic, to tell ourselves to map together the language side and the words with the visual or the non-verbal cues. As you said, imagine I'm looking for a red book. I'm going to tell myself to think of things that are red and put the word red into my brain at the same time.
Yes, absolutely. And I think this, you can instruct yourself to pick up on certain information. So the brain looks at the world with certain settings. So if you enter a room and you're instructed to look at the architecture of that room, your attention will be guided by that task that you're currently doing. So what I can everyone advise, and that makes a very interesting assignment almost, is to go into a new room with a specific assignment and do that again with a different assignment, or have two people walk into the same room and all give them different assignments. And this results in a situation in which you're both picking up on different information. And the nice thing about this assignment is that it makes you realize that the other person is looking at the world differently. And if we want to communicate, we have to be aware that the worldview of someone might be different. And this is, to me, the big eye-opener of my work, is the fact that I now understand where all these differences come from. And I think a lot of miscommunication comes from the fact that we think the other person is seeing the same things. And that makes it very difficult to understand each other, and also to understand where differences come from. Like, how is it possible that you view the world so differently than I do? And I think attention is the key in understanding how that's possible. We're looking at the same world, but we're all picking up on different information.
And is that a situation where the context that we inhabit, all of us, is always interpreted through our own filter? Is it because, you know, there's nonverbal, there's verbal, there's visual, there's non-visual, there's all the various sensory perceptions that we have that give us information. But for each individual, are we filtering the world through our own experience and knowledge and perhaps DNA?
Absolutely. So when I talk about the visual domain, this is just an illustration, because the filtering process works for all senses, but also works for internal processes like thinking. We have to select. We cannot think of multiple things at the same time. We have to select all the sensory information coming into our brain. So filtering is one of the basic mechanisms of our brain. So when I talk about the visual information, it's only an illustration of what's actually a general property of the brain.
How do we get on the same page or start to perceive things in the same way that others might be? Is it possible to bridge that difference?
It's possible, but it's difficult. So one way of doing it is being fully aware of these principles. So that's, I think, that's, this podcast is important, and reading books about this topic. It takes some time for audio to realize. And all these illustrations, like the gorilla, the very famous gorilla with the basketball players, but there are multiple of these illustrations. Don't think of those as funny examples, but realize that that's what's happening in the world. So it takes some time in order to realize that your perception is biased. And then a second step that you can take is to actually try to step into someone else's bubble. So I know that there are some newspapers that you might not like, some websites, some social media platforms that you might not like because they present a view that is not congruent with your view. But it's interesting to actually step in someone else's bubble. And what I've, and one assignment that I've been giving and also doing myself, is to look at someone else's, for instance, Facebook timeline, and see what type of information this person is presented with. And not someone that you agree with, but someone that you completely disagree with. And just look at the type of information that this person is receiving. And it might not change your own information or your own views about the world, but it might change the way you look at this other person.
You're listening to the Curious Advantage podcast, inspired by the book The Curious Advantage, written by Paul Ashcroft, Simon Brown, and Garrick Jones. Subscribe to the podcast today.
Steph, you talked about principles and practices there, and you gave us some of the examples. Do you have a set of things that you're thinking about when you're looking to step into somebody else's bubble or see things from a different perspective? Are there a set of things that you might run through or try and do in different situations?
So, as everyone, I generally believe that I'm right. And so what I try to do is, when I'm stating such a statement, like, for instance, about climate change, I really take one step back and think, what's the evidence? What's my evidence? Where do I get this information from? So be conscious of your own bubble and reevaluate. And I sometimes reevaluate and really try to step away from my own ideas and talk to other people and really listen and see if I'm perhaps incorrect. And this has led me to the situation. I'm really good in saying that I'm wrong. I'm really good. And I've learned that over the last couple of years to doubt and to come into the situation where I realize that I might be incorrect and really listen to other people and also investigate how they come to their views. And perhaps they are right.
We've been working with investigative journalists, and investigative journalists are very interesting for us because they're a community of people who have skills about how to enter new contexts, how to create trust in those contexts so that they can ask questions and be trusted and allow people to open up to them. But at the same time, they have to maintain critical distance. They have to be able to not get emotionally involved. They have to be able to withdraw, maintain the integrity of those relationships, and also be able to write completely subjectively about them in ways that the people they've met may not like, for example. So this idea of entering context or other bubbles that other people inhabit takes skill. I wanted to ask you about critical bias. Do you have any views on how we should pay attention to the biases that we have?
I think it's important to realize that your initial interpretation of the world might not be correct. So I think the brain is set up to look at things just rapidly and interpret the world in a way that's quick, because we have to take fast decisions. But what I've realized over the last couple of years is my first impression might absolutely be incorrect. And actually, the most of the times, it's incorrect. And I think you cannot change that first interpretation of the world. The biases are there. You need those. The brain needs to make sense of the world quickly and rapidly. But luckily, in a lot of situations, you have the time. You have the time to take a second look and to be aware of those biases. And I think in a lot of time, my first impression of the world might be filled with wrong ideas. And sometimes I have to act based on that first impression. But when you realize that if you have the time to take a second look, you can look at this situation with different settings and try to look and this results in different biases. So you can overcome these biases, first of all, by taking time and by viewing it in multiple ways and try to connect with other people, see how they look at a situation, and then try to not stick too much to your first interpretation and reevaluate. And if you have the knowledge that this first impression of the world is biased, this is extremely helpful.
Mm. Steph, I've heard you talk about the phrase, the attentional window, and large attentional windows or smaller attentional windows. What do you mean by that?
So an attentional window is the size of your spotlight. So when you think about attention, we use the metaphor of the attentional spotlight, which travels through space and picks up information around, and the rest of the information is simply ignored. But as a spotlight in a theater, your attentional spotlight can also change in size. So when you're reading something, you have a small attentional spotlight. You're focusing on the letters, on the individual words. However, when you're in a supermarket for the first time and you're looking for your favorite pack of milk, you have a large spotlight. So you're not focusing on the details, but you want to have an overview of the world around you. So what we're constantly doing is we're zooming in and we're zooming out, giving the task that we have. So when you're focusing on the details, you have a small spotlight, and when you want to have an overview, you have a large spotlight. And there are some very interesting individual differences between people who are more able to look at the world with a smaller spotlight and other people who tend to look at the world with a large spotlight. And we all know the people around us who focus on the details, and we know the people around us that focus on the larger story, on the bigger picture. And that's important, again, in a team to focus on, to have people included that tend to focus on the details and tend to focus sort of the bigger picture.
A curious culture is a game changer. What does curiosity mean for you? Follow hashtag CuriousAdvantage and join the conversation.
Steph, we live in a really distracting world. I know in your book Concentration, that's coming out soon in English, you start to talk about how concentration works. But could you say a little bit about what's the difference between concentration and attention? And what have you been studying in terms of what you've learned about how concentration works?
So attention is the filtering process. So what do you pick up from the world around you right now? And concentration is to keep that going for a longer period of time. So attention is one moment in time. What are you attending right now? Concentration is sustained attention. So focus on a specific task or on a specific stimulus in the external world for a longer period of time. And that's difficult. As you said, there are so many distractions in the world around us that, and not only around us, but also internal distractions. So your mind starts to wander all the time. If you've ever done meditation, you know how difficult it is to focus on one task for a longer period of time before your mind starts to wander. And that's why meditation is a really good training method for concentration, because it makes you aware of all the distractions that are there and how to deal with all those distractions. So meditation is almost like the key to concentration. It's like hyper-concentration. It's concentration boiled down to its essence. Focus on something and ignore external and internal distractions. What's nice about meditation is it makes you so aware why concentration outside of the meditation process is so extremely difficult, because there are so many of these distractions in the external, in the external, and in the internal world. So one thing to realize is that it's not easy to focus. Focus is complicated. And you need to train this, and you need to make sure that your environment is made in such a way that concentration is actually possible.
And Steph, certainly in my experience and what I know of meditation is something that you can get better at and do for longer periods of time with more practice. I presume it's the same with concentration. With practice and the right type of practice, it's something you can get better at as well.
Absolutely. It's like a muscle. You need to train it. And everyone has the capacity to do it. Of course, there are individual differences in the amount of muscle strength that you can actually gain. But it's definitely possible for everyone to train your focus and your concentration. And it's actually not that difficult. Simply do it. So start making training schedule, make assignments, and be very clear about what you want to achieve. Do you want to be able to read a book again? Do you want to be able to work on a specific project for a longer period of times? It's definitely something that you can train. And again, meditation is a very good concentration exercise as well. And it generalizes. So your abilities that you learn during meditation generalize to to other tasks.
I saw some research from completely the other side of the field, Steph, that doctors and surgeons in particular, who were good at video games, showed better concentration skills in surgery and more accurate surgery over time. And the correlation was with their video gaming skills. What's the relationship between games and concentration and attention?
Yeah, so currently I think it's much of that is still correlational. There are some studies out there that have looked at more experimental setups, so actually a control group and a gaming group of people who have never played games before. And that's relatively convincing. I have to say it's a small literature, and we don't know which specific games actually do the trick. We do know that a lot of the brain training apps don't work. You actually become better at the app, but it doesn't generalize. So be aware here, and be sure to check the scientific data if somebody claims to have a solution. A lot of the things are correlational or are not backed up by scientific data at all. This is something that is still under the radar and has to be investigated a lot more. And that's in contrast to meditation. That's why I'm making quite a strong claim about meditation. I do think that the evidence is quite convincing for meditation. For other types of training, I'm a bit skeptical still.
That's interesting.
So, Steph, just to return to curiosity, it seems that there are similarities in your research and what we've been understanding about curiosity, in that being successfully curious is in some way about sticking to it, not just wondering why and stopping there, and then, I guess in your words, getting distracted by something else, but more like concentration over time and just doing it. Is there something that you've learned or that you've been discovering about how we can be better or more successful about being curious?
When you say this, I tend to think about actually two settings that the brain has. So one is complete focus. And as you mentioned, that's extremely important for a longer period of time, focus on a specific task. So focus is important, but doing nothing, so let your mind wander for a while, might also be important, because there's a different brain network actually involved when you're mind wandering compared to when your brain is in complete focus. So if you want to make full use of the capacity of the brain, you also want to include the brain areas that might not be involved when you're doing, when you're concentrating for a longer period of time. So I think a right balance between mind wandering and deep focus is important if you want to make use of the full capacity of the brain while you're being curious.
Steph, this is a fascinating conversation. It's great chatting to you. What are the take-homes, or what are the things you'd like our listeners to remember?
I think I would really like the listeners to remember that your perception of the world is limited, but that's not a problem. It's actually a solution to a huge problem, actually, because we cannot deal with all the incoming information. But that means that our attention is something that's very precious. It's a limited resource, and I would like everyone to use their attention well and focus on the relevant information and try to ignore the information that's irrelevant to you or might not be worth paying attention to. It's a resource. Try to think of it as something as very valuable and use it wisely, I would say.
You've been listening to another edition of the Curious Advantage podcast. Thanks to Stefan de Stichel for a fascinating conversation. Thank you, Stefan.
You're very welcome.
I encourage everyone to get a hold of his books, How Attention Works, and Concentration, when it comes out this month from MIT Press. Please subscribe and join in the conversations online and on LinkedIn. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Curious Advantage podcast. The Curious Advantage book is now available to purchase on Amazon. Subscribe to the podcast today. Follow #CuriousAdvantage and join the conversation. This podcast is produced by Aliki Palinelli and John McGinty and edited by Jill Damatak-Futter.